How would you like to climb up over the Sierra Nevadas with me in this episode? I'm going to try to help you get a feel for that majestic mountain range. If we left Salt Lake at dawn, we could usually get past the Sierra Nevadas to the Emerald Triangle between 8 and 10 p.m. But if we left later in the day, which we often did, we would try to get to at least Reno, spend the night there, and start up through the mountain passes the next morning. Again, we had the same damn problem in Reno with our favorite hotels and restaurants that we had at the rental agency and gas stations. First of all, you can't rent a hotel room with just cash unless you want to put down a $250 cash deposit and wait for the maid to go clean your room in the morning before you can get your cash back. Right. It's simply impossible to not leave a hotel digital footprint. Hi, Mr. Benson. Would you like to join our Silverado Gold Club? No, thank you. Are you sure? We see you here so often the house will comp your room or your meals. Ugh. So tempting. How do you respond to an offer too good to refuse?
No, thank you. I'm Mormon. I can't. We hate free things.
We usually stayed on the edge of Reno near the interstate. They also have marvelous casinos and restaurants in the heart of the city, but it takes almost 20 minutes just to get there from the interstate. Just so many stoplights and miles to add on to an already really long trip. In spite of that, we always had a lot of fun staying in Reno at the Silverado or El Dorado casinos, mostly shopping in some of the blingy shops in Plain 21 and going to Roxy's restaurant at the El Dorado Hotel. I loved the plush chairs and the colored pink ambient lights and brick walls, drinking an ice-cold lemon martini with a real pour with Belvedere vodka was the best. Not like the half-ounce pours you get in lame-ass, teetotaling, Mormony-ass Utah. In Utah, the Mormon Church controls all the liquor distribution and sledgehammer legislative liquor laws. We can only buy liquor at state-owned liquor stores here in Utah, or a bar, or some of the restaurants. Oh, and 3% alcohol beer in the grocery stores! Who even makes 3% alcohol beer? In most places, they make it convenient to buy wine and spirits in drug and grocery stores. But oh no, not here. These Mormon administrators think that if they micromanage the sale and rate of consumption, they can control the rest of us heathens from becoming alcoholics. They make all kinds of ridiculous serving policies they know nothing about. It's like having your grandma plan a rave at the gym in the local YMCA. These administrators do things like, the server is not allowed to put more than one drink down on the table per person. So if the bar is busy and you know it's going to be slow, you go ahead and order your second martini, then the bartender surprises the hell out of you and gets it out there before you're not quite done drinking the first one. You have to gulp your drink before the server can set the next one on the table. I think that helps us to not become alcoholics, don't you? You can't order a double pour in Utah. Hell, you can barely even order a single pour in Utah. Every drink you get in Utah is usually a little over a half ounce. They water down the shit out of them. Trust me. Come to Utah and try to order a drink and just see how weird it gets. Mormon Nanny Church knows how to keep us all on the straight and narrow. I think those people are going to have so much fun in heaven together. I'll sign up to bring the Diet Coke to the Saturday night cherub choir party. Doesn't that sound like fun? God, thank goodness I'm not going to be there in heaven with them. Anyway, I digress. I was talking about Roxy's. The staff there was always so elegant and amazing. And after we gulped a couple of power martinis, Bob always ordered the ribeye. And I love the Wagyu burger. It's to die for. And so were the homemade buttered rolls. Ah, the wild mushroom truffle mac and cheese was really wonderful. And my favorite, shoestring fries, and as always, lobster and crab. Oh gosh, I could go on and on about Roxy's. Now I'm hungry, aren't you? Go get a snack and I'll wait. We always had to use a lot of discipline to only go to Roxy's about every third or fourth trip. And it wasn't that hard because a lot of times we didn't even get to Reno until about 10 o'clock and all the good places were closed by then anyway. So we'd be stuck with Denny's 24 all-day breakfast. You may not believe this, but we actually never drank too much or stayed out too late that much. Well, you know, most of the time because come dawn, we were up and at it again facing the next big obstacle. The Sierra Nevadas. Dum, dum, dum. Whoa, those things are high. Sometimes, if the timing was right, we would stop just past the way station and the state line in Truckee, California, which is just about 30 minutes or less west of Reno, at a little hippie grocer called the New Moon. I love the smell of their homemade soaps and essential oils and the patchouli. But the best thing about that little vortex right there on the premises, they squeezed the best orange, carrot, and ginger juice. And the deli was even better. They used super fresh bread with no additives and great grass-fed meats and cheeses on the sandwiches. We not only fueled up our car in Truckee, but freshly squeezed juice helped to fuel up our courage to be able to face what was coming up on the interstate. Descending down the beautiful valley of the turquoise Donner's Lake is very deceptive. The pristine view of those jagged, sharp mountains jutting out of the sides of the banks of the crystal lake lulls the unsuspecting traveler into its beauty, making them unaware of the ominous and foreshadowing horrors soon to come. That view seduces you into pretty much taking your life into your own hands. Yes, sir. There's a ferocious competition for space on that treacherous section of the interstate. For whatever reason, the entire time, over 10 years that we drove. Oh, I'm just kidding. It was only 9. Actually, it was about 4 or 5. The entire time that we drove that stretch of the road, construction crews were working on it, tearing the living daylights out of it. Do construction crews ever finish anything? I mean, it seems like to me, with highways and construction crews, it's just a loop. They just go round and round and they never, ever finish anything. And it was just like this on this section of Interstate 80. Everything was always torn down to only 2 lanes each, east and west of narrow, and I mean narrow road. It wasn't like there was any room for mistakes to veer out of your lane either. They had these huge construction blocks locking in both the outside lanes with about a foot wide shoulder. We had to drive like fighting pit bulls to keep our place. You remember in driver's ed when they teach you to keep one car's length for every 10 miles of speed? Ha! Oh, no! Hell no! Not in California. You have to drive with a foot or less between you and the guy in front of you to keep other people who don't understand boundaries from weaseling in front of you on the long lines of 18-wheelers, the big machinery, and equipment haulers. And if that's not enough, about 9 months out of the year, it's winter up there at Donner's Pass. The winter is brutal up there because of the high elevations. Absolutely brutal. Snow, ice, rain, slush, and fog just gets worser and worser the higher you climb through the Tahoe Forest and the mountain pass. You're trying to pass 18-wheeler rigs who are hauling extra wide loads of big-ass cat dump trucks, or even the four 15-foot tall wheels they use for the cat dump trucks. And it's raining and snowing, and it's so nerve-wracking. These rigs lumber up the mountain pass at about 40 miles an hour, and it's sketchy as hell for cars who are trying to pass, because if there's only a foot or two between you and the outside and these huge rigs and a foot on the shoulders, their humongous tires splash snow and mud all over your windshields, making it visibly so bad sometimes you can't see shit. Your windshields are going full speed, but it doesn't matter. You're really just driving by feel. I can't see a thing. I'm getting close. I don't ever think about overcorrecting. The snow and ice make it super slippery and squirrely. One little jerk on the brakes and you're in a full 360, about ready to become a metal waffle. And this, my friends, is when the pass is open. Sometimes we would be trapped for hours in mile-long lines waiting for the weather to ease up. They had closed the interstate behind us, so we were stuck in the middle, or for the accidents to clear up, or whatever reason. During those times when we'd be stuck up there, the cops would single the cars over to the side, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that cop wants to talk to us. And Bob's like, calm the hell down. Shh, he's here. Hi, officer. And the cop leans down all concerned and shit, and he politely says, hello, sir. We're advising only those of you with four-wheel drive or chains to continue from here on out. So you be real careful out there, folks. Already? And I'm like, thanks, officer. We will. Whew, that was a close one. Bob looks at me. He's all disgusted. And he says, close your damn eyes and go to sleep, okay? I'll wake you when it's over. You're making me nervous. And I close my eyes and I'm like this. This is how I travel when I'm going through Donner class. Oh, please, Heavenly Father. I'm petting my hell. Oh, we're going to die. Oh, Heavenly Father, please. We're going to die. Please, God. There are no atheists up on Donner's pass. Needless to say, driving up Donner's Pass through the Sierra Nevadas can be quite an ordeal, even in modern times like today. It gives me a headache just making my knuckles white telling you about it. Whew, I need a drink. You know why it's called Donner's Pass, don't you? Some of you do, not all of you. It's a very famous American story. The pass was named after two wealthy brothers, Jacob and George Donner. These two brothers got a big idea that they were going to supposedly find a better and shorter route out to Cali. Those two talked a group of California-bound settlers from Springfield, Illinois, into going with them to strike it rich, and on April of 1846, the group took off. Sure enough, they ran into such rough terrain and numerous delays that they eventually became trapped by heavy snowfall high up in the Sierra Nevadas, right there by Donner's Lake. By early November, the Donner party found that the route had been blocked by so much snow they were forced to spend the winter on the east side of the mountain range there at that lake. Did you know that out of the 81 settlers, only 45 survived that winter to reach California? And some of the ones who did survive were only able to do so by resorting to cannibalism. Yes, sir, you heard me right. Not cannabis, cannibalism. Ooh, ew, yuck. That's why it's so famous. Sometimes when Bob and I were trapped in the car behind the long lines in the interstate fighting that terrible weather at Donner's Pass, I used to think these creepy, macabre thoughts about the Donner party. My little brain would start fretting and think that, well, if we don't get the hell over this damn mountain range really quick, maybe all of us in the interstate might end up like the Donner party, resorting to having to eat each other. After all the Pringles ran out, we start acting like zombies, stomping through the snow and ice and stalled cars, pulling out little babies from their car seats and chomping on their little legs. Nom, 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 nom. Just tastes like chicken drums. Nom, 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 nom. Anxiety gives you pretty weird psychosis. There's really a lot of amazing recorded American history along that part of the trip. All along the interstate, you can look up and see train tunnels high above the river ravines in the interstate. The railroad twists and weaves in and out of the granite rock. Building this part of the Transcontinental Railroad was probably the hardest part of all the rail line that was ever built in America. Back in the 1840s, construction conditions were so severe that the railroad company couldn't even get workers to apply for the job. Keeping the construction of this mammoth project on schedule was completely impossible because the long mountain range was made out of solid granite rock, the hardest stone in the world. Trying to drill through the mountain range was such hard work that most of the Black and Caucasian people in California would only work in the mines or agriculture. Can you imagine trying to drill through the granite without modern machinery like we have today? Fortunately for the railroad company, the timing was just right when over 300,000 Chinese immigrants flooded into the U.S. between the 1840s and the 1860s. These immigrants came because of political terror and terrible poverty in their country at the time. Americans in general and the railroad employers were quite racist against the Chinese at the time. The company had no choice but to hire these immigrants as manual laborers instead, but to the delight and surprise of the employers, the Chinese proved themselves to be phenomenal workers, despite how small the Chinese immigrants were and their lack of experience. These laborers were responsible for most of the heavy manual labor on the lines of the Sierra Nevada rails. Because only a very limited amount of work could be done by the animals or the little machines or dynamite. These poor guys toiled through back-breaking labor during both frigid winters and blazing summers. Hundreds of immigrants died from the explosions, the landslides, the accidents, and disease. Most of these immigrants were peasants and farmers and craftsmen from China. They were all young men who were usually married, and they had to leave behind their wives and children since they were just going to stay in the country for just a temporary time. The wives were never allowed to come along because they had to remain behind. It's a Chinese tradition of matriarchal obligation that the wives had to care for the husband's parents. The men would send a large part of the money they earned in America back to China. The families, the unions, the guilds, and sometimes entire villages, and sometimes the whole region, sent almost all of their young men to California. From that point forward, the railroad preferred to hire the Chinese, and even set up recruiting efforts in Canton, China. In 1864, the Chinese workers were paid $26 a month and worked 6 days a week, doing this back-breaking labor. But the black and white workers that worked for the railroad were paid $30 a month and given food and lodging, even though the Chinese were doing all the heavy lifting. The Chinese immigrants only received 70 to 50% of the wages that the whites received for the same job, and they had to pay for their own food unlike everybody else. On top of having the most difficult and dangerous work, including tunneling and the use of explosives, some of them faced a lot of physical abuse from the railroad supervisors. They didn't really realize yet that slavery was against the law by then. Finally, the immigrants cracked, and protesting the long hours, the lower pay, and the abuse, they used their collective strength that they challenged the railroad company and held an 8-day strike in June of 1867. In spite of that, the strike ended without any pay parity after the Central Pacific cut their food supply off and transportation off. So they had no food and they couldn't go anywhere. They had to go back to work. Fortunately, the strike wasn't in vain because the working conditions soon improved following the strike. The railroad raised their wages to $35 a month. That's the equivalent of $630 in the year 2018 per month after the strike. That still seems pretty bad. It makes you think that some things just really never change. Can you imagine doing that kind of work for minimum wage? Oh, I could go on and on about the injustices done to the Chinese immigrants, but I'm about out of time. I used to look up at those railroads in awe and wonder who dug the tunnels and who built the lines hanging off the cliffs of the Sierras. On my days off from driving, sometimes I would look up the history. Today, I wanted to honor the forgotten but important group of immigrants that helped build our nation. So remember, stay out of trouble. And when you're biting on little chubba chunk baby thighs and their little tummers, don't bite too hard. I know those little babykins are just so cute, you just want to eat them alive. You love them so. I'm having a new baby granddaughter next week, and I'm so excited. And for sure, don't do it. Don't do anything I would do. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.